Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cove.
I'm Peter Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And John, it is our 500th show.
Who'd have thunk it? Well, that's quite an achievement. Congratulations, mate.
Well, you've been there for most of the journey, I think pretty much all of it.
Yeah, at the very beginning I used to make the phone calls.
But yeah, 15 years on air, or on the internet anyway, as well as on air, and our 500th show. We were hoping to have a very special guest, but unfortunately that particular person was not available at the moment. Suddenly they got very busy with their work, but they are saying that they may be available down the track. So when we get that confirmed, you will find out who it is, and you'll probably understand why we couldn't get them today. But we do still have a very important guest, and that is Alex Chiat, the Sport New Zealand Talent Development Manager, talking about the developments in New Zealand sport and how they're really trying to change the landscape there. I think you'll find it be really, really interesting if you care about your sport and the pathways that have been created. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
And who's going to start today?
You go.
All right, I'm going to start then with the winner. Don't be like that. Women's Cricket World Cup. First of all, I'm going to say congratulations to Australia on winning it again. I'm also going to say congratulations to the organisers for pricing it right when it got to the final, because obviously having $20 for adults, $5 for children, managed to get them the crowd of 86,174. Fantastic crowd at the MCG for a women's sporting event, and I thought that was really, really good. Now, as you know, I don't normally watch T20. I did actually watch one game of T20 during the Women's World Cup.
Attended, I believe.
I did attend it, exactly. Oh. Now, that's what my kind of conversation piece is going to be about today. So what happened was, there was a game in Perth. Didn't even know that any of the World Cup games were being held in Perth. I had no idea. And then the day before, somebody said, would you like to come, South Africa versus England? And I thought, you know what, why not? So went along, obviously, being originally from England, my wife being originally from South Africa, it was an interesting thing, dynamic for the family. So went along to that. And I must admit, as a game, really enjoyed it. But as an actual spectacle in terms of being held at the Wacker, the crowd that was so, so small, I think there were only 2,000 people there. It was really disappointing. And the atmosphere, there wasn't really any. And then if you also took into account the sort of whole ground, I don't know if you'd call it entertainment, but the people that were on the pitch talking about the game, that was just, oh, I thought it was awful. It was painful.
I have a problem with that sometimes because, yes, they put them up on the screen, but the audio very often from those things is terrible because you're getting it from speakers all around the ground, and it just sounds like it's very hard very often to even figure out what they're saying. So
yeah,
it looks great on TV. I'm sure it works perfectly well on TV.
Yeah, I would agree. The sound was terrible there. But and I mean, the thing I was thinking about with that is – and I know when I was coming up through the ranks playing cricket, you know, you want to play on these big grounds. You want to be able to say, I played at the Wacker, I played at the Gabba, I played at the SCG. For me, you know, in England, it was you wanted to play at the Oval, you wanted to play at Trent Bridge and all of these grounds. And a couple of those, you know, I was fortunate that I did get to play on, you know, established cricket grounds, and it was fantastic to have played there. I mean, I remember playing at the Oval, but I think there were probably three people watching, you know, and two of those were the coaches of Surrey because it was a game to try and, you know, a trial game for that. But that was fantastic. But I think the sad thing was it was a World Cup and it should be well attended, and you want a crowd and you want an atmosphere. And I just wonder whether they got that wrong and whether it might have been better to have sort of gone for like a Lilac Hill where we used to have, you know, festival games by the Swan River out in Midland, and you could actually get a smaller crowd, but it would create a really good atmosphere, still be a spectacle, and it would have been something that I think probably those who played in the games here in Western Australia would have probably remembered that more than they might remember the game at the Wacker. I don't know. They may have been very happy that they got the chance to play on what is traditionally regarded as one of the fastest tracks in the world, or it was, and they could at least say that. But just to me, there was something missing, and I think the marketing of the whole tournament was pretty poor.
I was certainly aware that the tournament was going to happen.
Yeah, I knew it was happening.
Courtesy of Channel 9 and Gem. because they did quite a little bit of advertising about their coverage, but I had no idea until, as you, like a day before or something, that we were having those games in Perth. I didn't see any local marketing going on necessarily. It was all at this national level that, yeah, it's a pity, because I probably would have made the attempt to go along and watch a game or two, especially when I find out that it wasn't that many people there. It would have been easy to get a beer and easy to get a hamburger.
Oh, it was very, yeah, it was good in that respect. And you know, the thing that I actually enjoyed, and this might sound strange, was, you know, South Africa beat England in that game, and it was fantastic because you knew that the South African women, the money in their program compared to the money in the English women's program would have been poles apart. And so it was fantastic to see, although it sounds terrible to say this about South Africa, a developing nation, maybe in women's cricket, do so well and beat one of the established nations. I thought that was fantastic, and it was really encouraging. And I think that's one of the things I am actually really enjoying about women's sport, is that you do see those sort of things happening now a lot more than you're seeing in the men's games.
I think something else that worked in the tournament's favour was Australia losing to India in the first game. I think if Australia had have won that game, the narrative of the whole tournament would have changed. But because they lost that game, suddenly they were in a position where they were going to be a whole hell of a lot more vulnerable. And it turned out that way. They were lucky to get through. Because they lost that game to India, they finished second. And if the weather gods had have changed slightly, things could have been a very vastly different story.
They could. And the other thing I think that's come up at the end of it was obviously the weather intervened. And it is incredible, I think, that in a tournament where you think it's only T20, 40 overs, it's not that long, that you don't have a backup plan if games can't be played. Now, I totally understand one day international is slightly different because it's a longer format. But I still think the way the recent World Cup was, they could have replayed some of those games if you looked at it, because teams had 7 or 8 days gap between games. So that could have been slotted in. I looked at it when some of those rain-affected games.
Don't forget the semi-final involving New Zealand and India went to a second day.
Yeah.
So they actually continued the game.
Yeah, I'm in favour of that, but I just think we need to have more than that. If you're going to host a World Cup, nowadays people do not want teams to go through on bizarre sort of statistics or the Duckworth-Lewis system or whatever. I think it needs to be a proper game if it can be played.
Yeah, look, the idea of having a... It's written in the rules before everybody starts.
Oh, totally. I accept that, but I'm not saying... that I think it needs to be reviewed.
I think it was a bit cheeky of Cricket Australia to ask, after the fact, to have the, you know, change the fixture essentially, especially considering as how they didn't do it for the Big Bash when they deemed the integrity of the fixture to be too greater than the
hypocrisy of sports administrators.
Exactly, and that was a bit disappointing, to be honest. They should have just backed up should have said, no, that's it, we're not moving nothing. Because they're your rules. Remember, that's the integrity of the competition.
Sorry, integrity?
Oh, don't go there. It's really... look, I thought the tournament was successful on many levels. It certainly seemed to raise a huge amount of awareness in this country for women's sport and women's cricket in particular. And I think it did create a few new heroes. They released the new... Common Aussie, come on version for the girls, and yeah, that's all great and it's all fun. I'm not sure how much of an impact it has outside of Australia.
Yeah, personally, I would have liked them to have had their own song. I mean, it was like, you know, rehashing an old thing. It was, yeah, I mean, it worked and it was okay, but I just think, you know, let's show them a respect. They've suddenly, the women's game has come up from somewhere. So
maybe do a cover of a Katy Perry song and just change the lyrics.
Whatever. Yeah, exactly. I mean, but I totally agree. I think as a tournament as a whole, it was a huge success and I think it was really good. But I just felt that in some areas, certainly here in Western Australia, the marketing of it and the promotion of it was non-existent.
I'd actually turned on a game and realised it was at the Wacker, and I could have actually have been there.
Yeah, there you go. Backs up my point.
It does indeed. But a great lucky triumph for Australia in the end. They squeezed through. India, congratulations to the Indian girls, because I think they had a really good tournament.
They played really well. from what I read, as I say, I
watched them play. They've got a couple of.
I listened to it on the radio, I must admit.
The thing about India and most of the teams, you know what separates all of these women's teams? They've all got people that can hit. They've all got some big hitters. They've all got people that can bowl. It's the fielding which is the difference. And you watch the Australian girls versus the Indian girls in fielding, and they are miles apart. We saw I watched the first India-Australia game with my partner, Debbie, and she immediately picked up. The Indian girls look like third graders, and that's the big area that separates all of these teams at the moment. And I'm sure it's got something to do with funding, because the Australians train together so much more often and have so much more opportunity to do it than a lot of the other teams. I dare say England would be close to them. The West Indies have got some phenomenal fielders, but they're very erratic. That's going to be the next big change in women's cricket, I think, is the quality of the fielding. Because there's undoubtedly the batters and the bowlers there.
Yeah, it's funny, the game I went to...
Even though it's a short boundary.
The game I went to, I thought the field placing at times, I was like, why have you not put someone there? You know that's where she's going to hit the ball next over. And lo and behold, the ball went there.
You'd call that more naivety than anything else, wouldn't you?
But it's interesting you say that about the fielding, because, you know, I'm a little bit older than you, but I remember in the 1970s, and if you actually compared the England cricket team's fielding to the Australian cricket team's fielding, the Australian fielders were outstanding. You know, you had Doug Walters, I think Paul Sheehan was around then, Ross Edwards, Ian Chappell. There were some fantastic fielders. England were a bit ponderous, I would say, in the field.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
You know, they were slow. They didn't really chase the ball hard to the boundary to try and prevent it getting to the boundary. And I think it was actually, you know, that Ian Chappell era, and certainly when Mike Brearley came in, it was one of the things that he felt needed to change drastically, and England improved their fielding from then on. So maybe it's, again, it's one of those generational things. It just needs somebody to say, hey, we're behind, we need to improve.
Oh, yeah, and Australia took it to a new level under Bob Simpson, and that really led the rest of the world. The West Indies had always had great fielders, but it was Clive Lloyd or Viv. They weren't all fantastic fielders. Bob Simpson comes into the Australian setup, and suddenly all of these guys were a reasonable fielder. They all had the basics of being able to field well. The outstanding ones were still doing the outstanding stuff, but the guys at the bottom of the list were bringing themselves up to a minimum standard. And the Australian teams, although they were getting beaten, were some of the best fielding teams in the world. And a lot of games they were playing during those dark years that they did win was on the basis of their fielding being able to restrict teams by 30 or 40 runs every innings.
But you're absolutely right, because, I mean, Gordon Greenidge is a prime example when he went down to Hampshire. I mean, he was scoring mountains of runs, but he was conceding so many runs in the field because he was like, I hate fielding, don't want to do it. And he felt, and then they sat him down and said, listen, you know, you have a job to do after you finish batting. You score 100, but if 100 get knocked past you because you can't be bothered to dive, and they told him, if you don't improve, you're out. And then, of course, he did improve, but he also became one of the best slip fielders the West Indies have probably ever had.
Well, yeah, there's a place for slip fielders too.
Hi, I'm Daniel Ricciardo, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, as I mentioned, we have a special guest on this, our 500th show, and we're going to be catching up now with Alex Kiert, the Sports New Zealand Talent Development Manager, because there's some really interesting developments taking place in New Zealand. Now, in Australia, we're used to winning at sport, and winning is an important part of life, yet we're seeing more and more nations catch us up and surpass us. Now, I'm a firm believer some of this is because we've moved away from the core aspects of sport, and the pathways have been created that are supposedly going to deliver excellence, but as they found in New Zealand, they're not delivering as much as they thought. Alex Kiert, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
Well, really looking forward to catching up with you and discussing sort of some of the issues that Sport New Zealand appear to have discovered or unearthed or decided to make changes to. And one of those is that, you know, we've been told that the pathway is the way to success, but I believe that you guys now have sort of realised that this may be one of the reasons why you're not achieving the results at the highest level in international sport. I mean, how did those findings come about?
Oh, look, this is not something that's happened sort of overnight. We've been doing a lot of work in this sort of area for many years, at least sort of quite deliberately the last four. So we've been talking to our people, our leaders in sport here in the country. We've been looking at best practice around the globe. We've been looking at research that sort of has always been there to help sort of inform some decisions that we're making. And you know, the pathway concept's an interesting one, and I think it's one that looks neat, and we like to have it on paper, and we need to provide direction and help. It's really important to show people sort of steps that they need to take in terms of their development, whether that's just playing for life or if it's stepping on into sort of national environments and the world stages. But the reality is that it's actually really hard to put everyone in one box. Well, the reality is you can't. Every individual sort of develops at different rates, and the sort of the real sort of a challenge is making sure our sports systems can accommodate and respond to the different needs of our young people today. So that's where we've been spending a lot of our time.
Yeah, I mean, I believe one of your roles at Sport New Zealand is to increase participation. So how much is the early specialisation, rather, and an overly competitive environment sort of caused the decline in young people sticking with sport and playing it just for fun?
Yeah, so we think through the work we've done, what we know is that we've got a problem. We know that we're losing kids from sport. We know that many kids aren't getting the opportunity to be active or getting a quality experience in sport. And we're seeing high-performance behaviours creep far too far down into young people's sport. And we also know that our young people's voice isn't being heard, and our sports system isn't responding to what they tell us, what they want, what they enjoy. So we've looked into this more, and sort of we came out with a sort of a Balance is Better document, which was sort of called our talent plan at the time, but it's evolved since then. But within that, we highlighted three issues that were very prevalent in youth sport. The first one was that there's sort of concept, you know, well, the first issue was that childhood success in most cases doesn't lead to adult success. The second issue is that, you know, early sport and early specialisation in terms of age is a real problem and a challenge. And the third sort of issue is that there's this sort of overemphasis on winning rather than development. And those three issues are challenging in two ways. One is if we want athletes to reach the top stage, a lot of them are getting burned out and broken down far too soon from some of these behaviours. So they're actually they're dropping out of sport, or they're not getting to the right stage of their development in a state where they can actually reach their potential. The second thing, and probably even the more important thing here, is actually because of these attitudes and behaviours, we're only looking after the competitive kids rather than every other child that wants the benefit from an active and a quality sporting experience. And our young people are telling us 70% of them want to play for more social participation motivations. 30% are really competitive and driven. Yet what tends to be happening throughout the country is, you know, kids are being put in string teams or representative teams at ages that we think are far too early, or we know are far too early. And unfortunately, the sports system starts to provide a lot of support for the minority of their athletes or participants, and the rest gets treated like second-class citizens, which just isn't right for our young people. So that's the work we've been digging into with our sports and starting to get some really good progress.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating area, and it's one that I've shown a lot of interest in recent times. Now, who is it that's pushing this elite barrow? Is it the sporting establishment? Is it because obviously they're continually telling us sport is a business? Is it the parents who see their child being the breadwinner down the track? Or is it the coaches? Or is it a combination of everybody?
Yeah, look, it's a really complex space. So I think, you know, to answer your questions, there's many people involved. Part of the challenge we've found is, you know, that a lot of the systems and pathways that are within sport have been there for a very long time, and unfortunately, the world around us has changed significantly. So when we start to look at our cultures, the people that are in our communities today, technology, obesity and inactivity. There's significant challenges that we're working against as a society, and our sports systems haven't changed at the same rate that the world around us has, and we're still sort of operating in old traditional paradigms. And, you know, part of this change, it's bloody hard because we're dependent on volunteers. I'm sure in Australia it's very similar to here in New Zealand. Like, you know, we've got a million sort of workforce of people that are giving volunteer time to deliver kids sport throughout the country on the Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings or throughout the week, depending on the sport. And without these people giving up their time, it's really hard to deliver sport. And these people are often giving up their time on top of jobs and everything else that's going on in their world. So when we start to say, hey, look, we've got to try and do things differently, of course they're going to move away from change. It's too hard. They're already, stretched with time. So what we've been working with our sports is, well, how do we make that easier and how do we ensure that happens? Because unfortunately, a lot of these ingrained systems that are in sports, and when I say that, I mean, you know, stream teams, representative teams, only looking after the competitive rather than some other social needs, lowering barriers in terms of cost and all these sorts of things that are so important today. We've got to help our sports system make those changes easier. So that's the work we've been doing, because the old systems are driving some of these negative behaviours, and parents are a big part of this challenge as well, where there's just not good understanding around what quality sport looks like, and there's perceptions out there, you know, and it aligns with those myths I outlined earlier. People think that that's fact and accurate, where it actually isn't the case, and we've got to change the conversation and get the right stories out there and then work with our sports system to change things, and that's the sort of journey we're on at the moment.
One thing that I find really interesting, because I've been fortunate to talk to a lot of former players who've played at the elite level and coaches at the elite level, and they've all been of the opinion that we've got too many underage teams, and one of the things that you've been looking at is to sort of cut the youth representative teams below the under 17 age group. Do you think that's going to be a really progressive thing? Because again, if you look at the statistics of how many of those go on and play at the elite level, it's not that many, is it?
Yeah, so that's sort of exactly the point where, from the work we've done and the research globally has always been there. So it's always said that it's a minority of kids that actually make these junior representative teams, whether they're school teams, whether they're rep teams, whether they're state teams, whatever it might be in your case. Very few of them go on to reach high performance levels. In fact, you've got a better chance if you don't make those teams and you come in later on in many sports of making it to the top. So this evidence and research has been around for a long time, and our sports have obviously looked at the work we've helped with in terms of evidence and done some homework themselves, and they're realising that, you know, that it's lose-lose by choosing some of these teams too early, because it's, again, you know, suddenly some kids are being told that they're talented, but they're good and they need special treatment, and others are being told that they're no good and there's not adequate support. And we know that these things are happening at an age where you can only see current potential, what's in front of you today, versus future potential. And a lot of these things are happening before maturation and before young people develop and grow. And young people, it's such a complex space with everything that's going on in their world, and quite often you can only see the physical stuff, not the mental, social, emotional, all these other facets. So what the sports have done is they've worked that out, and they've realised that these representative teams aren't actually helpful to either participation or performance. So they're putting in new programs that allows for different motivations of kids to stay involved in response to what the young people are saying, and that might be shorter seasons, that might be being able to try three sports within a season, that might be doing things at different times of the day or in more social settings, but that is also still providing the appropriate development for kids that are motivated and driven, because the misconception out here at times is that you're watering things down and this is just sort of PC world gone out of control, where no, it's not the case. This is doing what's best for our young people, and we've got the evidence and research to back it up.
I think it's a really interesting space because, you know, you've obviously got examples of Tiger Woods and Andre Agassi and maybe the Williams sisters who literally just played and played repetitively their sport, whereas you've got the likes of basketballer Steph Curry, Patrick Mahomes recently, you know, in the NFL, who said they played other sports and were really, you know, involved in other sports, and that's what made them excel at the sport they're in. So I just wonder how much Malcolm Gladwell's sort of 10,000 hours has actually been detrimental to the development of athletes.
Yeah, look, and I think this is part of the challenge. Unfortunately, specialisation is a pathway. That is one pathway to make it to the top. But when you dig into Cote's work and other research, sampling many sports when you're young and then starting to focus at an age where there's the intrinsic motivation and commitment to do it is far more successful for the majority of our athletes. So I think the media like to highlight, the Andre Agassi's, the Williams sisters, the Tiger Woods examples. But the reality is that's the minority of athletes that are performing at the world stage consistently. So we've been working really hard to dispel some of those myths. Look, it's hard, obviously, controlling the media. But again, trying to change the conversation and put other athletes out there. And I'm sure in Australia you'll have your own that have followed different journeys. But here, you know, we've got a group of Balance is Better champions. So a lot of our athletes that have followed the development journeys that we support, athletes at the moment like Sophie Devine, who is one of our top female cricketers who played hockey and cricket for New Zealand before focusing more on her hockey, on her cricket. Athletes like Jeff Wilson, who was one of our great All Blacks that many of your listeners will probably reference, who played cricket and rugby for New Zealand as a youngster. We've got, many other athletes and significant people are coming out in support of this change, which is helping sort of educate parents and nudge away at the change that's needed.
No, I think it's fantastic. I mean, you mentioned there about obviously current talent and future talent, which sort of comes into that talent identifiers or talent selectors, which, you know, you've identified when I was reading some of the documents is as a problem. So you're seeing people picking talent now and not looking to the future. And that's an art in itself, isn't it?
Well, look, I think if there was a secret recipe to identifying talent, women bottle it, get on the world circuit and go and sell it. Because no one's found it. And because it's just too complex and too hard to see. Yet, people keep trying to do it. And quite often it's uninformed volunteers trying to do the right thing because the system is forcing them to do things. You can only see current potential when you're doing these things. You can't see future potential. And look, you just need to look at, the sports that have significant resources behind them and the money that they can pour into trying to do these things, and they don't get it right. you look at English football, I think it's 0.05% of the kids that come into academies at a young age actually progress to make the first team. The numbers are just ridiculous. So we try to talk more about motivation ID here. So this is more about effort and commitment and the character of kids and those that are motivated and determined, that's sort of a better determinant of those that will go on and sort of develop the right skill sets and attitudes and behaviours and habits that will allow them to continue to work and to be coachable and actually to get into the environments at the right time and continually grow themselves, which is a better indicator of athletes and people that sort of succeed in life.
No, I think that was really interesting. You referenced the English Premier League because, you know, that stat is quite terrifying. But the other thing that I think you've unearthed as well was the fact that these early specialisation pathways have also seen an increase in youth sports injuries, which again is a real concern.
Yeah, there's a piece of work done by another government agency out here in New Zealand, ACC, where they're responsible for accident looking after the country in terms of injury in sport and in workplaces. And we've seen quite an acceleration of chronic injuries in young people that sort of is linked to, the commercialisation, professionalisation of sport, especially of kids, which is a concern, and the sort of race to the bottom where You know, people think that the whole housing and the academies and these words talent and elite are sexy, but they're actually really detrimental to our young people. And while there are some environments that provide a great experience, actually, a lot of them it's far too much too soon, and we need to sort of do what's right for our young people. We know better now. We know better than we did 10 years ago, so it's sort of up to us as parents and leaders in different roles to actually start to change some of these things and do what's right for our young people.
Now, Alex, I'd like to keep talking to you for a lot more, but obviously we've got a time limit on the show. But one thing I wanted to ask you was, if you look at New Zealand, it sounds like you've got the major sports on board, that they're really buying into the research that you guys have done and the fact that you're saying you're going to have to change the way things are being done. How difficult was it to get all the sports on board, and are they all really buying into it?
Look, to be honest, it wasn't hard. Look, we've been working with our partners for some time, and we started working with five sports a little bit more deeply to influence this change, and our choices around those five sports was because they had more, they had actually more people in their structures, they had leadership, they had commitment, they were already starting to move these sorts of things forward themselves. And we worked on some of the skill sets that were needed in their leaders to tackle this change. But what became evident in some of the work we were doing is they stepped back and said, guys, we're fighting the same enemy here. We're fighting social change, attitudinal change, behaviour change. While our context might be different than the sports that we play, actually, we've got to tackle this together. So it was a bit of a no-brainer to start to do a little bit more together on this. And what's come out of that you know, work over the last 18 months is the first five sports. So this is rugby in New Zealand, this is football, soccer, this is cricket, netball and hockey, field hockey here. They've sort of signed up to a pledge, a statement of intent, which we're calling our Balance is Better philosophy, to lead change. And that's actually all the sorts of things that we talked about here. That's ensuring that every kid gets a quality experience. We've got to focus on youth. It's leading attitude and behaviour change. It's providing leadership to their regions and associations and their clubs around how they tackle this. It's making sure that they work together and with the secondary school sports system. It's making sure that we start to allow our kids to play multiple sports again. So there's a whole host of things here that they've committed to. And they also committed to a campaign, and that's actually running at the moment, actually, where it's targeting adults, and it's actually, you know, it's a behaviour change campaign that's trying to raise more awareness amongst the parents, coaches and administrators in sport of the need to change for young people, so that over the next 4+ years, these sports will have a better chance of getting success as they tackle these traditional sports structures to keep all Kiwis involved in sport and make sure that every kid gets a good experience and can play at a level and a motivation that works for them and get those wider benefits to their well-being of being active and being with their mates and all the social cohesion and the leadership opportunities that presents, as well as giving a platform that those that have the motivation can reach the highest level if that's where the journey takes them at the right time and at the right pace. So we're right in the middle of that campaign at the moment. The sports are working together on this. We're about to announce another five sports to join this collective sort of pack, which is bloody exciting for us out here. By no means we've got this sorted, but we're getting some really exciting progress and we're getting some traction over here like we haven't had for decades.
Well, Alex, it's been great catching up with you. I really admire what you guys are trying to do, and I totally agree with where you're coming from in my experience in sport. And hopefully we can catch up again down the track and just see how it's all going and how those other sports have found it as well.
Oh, thank you. Ashley, thanks for the time.
Hello, my name is Joe Cortez, international boxing referee from Las Vegas, Nevada, the boxing capital of the world. Listen to Not the Footy Show. It's a knockout. Check it out.
Well, that was Alex Kiert, the Sport New Zealand Talent Development Manager. And some really interesting stuff there for me, John. The fact that they're doing away with all of those youth representative sides. I've always been in favour of it. I don't think there's any need probably below under 18s. I mean, they've got under 17s as their sort of cutoff point. But I think under 18s, under 90s, when you're maturing and you're pretty much at the age where, and you find out then who wants to play at elite level or who wants to play at representative level and who wants to just play for fun.
Yeah, all of those factors. I think also, you know, players have their abilities change over years. Who was the best player in your under 12s football team? Can you remember?
Oh, I can't remember. Oh, I can remember one guy. Yeah, probably my best friend, Brad Baker.
And where did Brad end up in the sports world?
He followed a career rather than actually playing.
Okay. You know? So a lot changes in a person's life between when they're a talented youngster and when they mature, and sometimes their level of talent peaks at 12. But if you're identified at 12, you're going to be going through that system, regardless of how your talent may or may not rise during that time, until you get to a point where you're so invested in the system and they cut you and you've got that. That's the end of your story. So many kids drop out because they don't think there's a future for them in the sport, because they're told that all the time that the only future is to play at representative or national level, or they're never given this option that sport can be something that is just not for nations to cheer on. It can be something to be a part of your life, being involved in an organisation for life.
I think this is the sad thing, and this is where I actually feel very sorry for a lot of clubs, because I think clubs, and if you take a lot of the sports now, they've got stuck between this thing. Whereas before, they ran their club to enter a local competition, they had a number of teams who were playing at all different levels and they were catering to them, and the club was the focus. It was like everybody wanted to wear that badge, whether you were playing...
The club existed solely for the purpose of the club existing.
Absolutely, and you played for that badge. It wasn't necessarily... And you were invested in the first team, you were invested if the fifth team got to the finals, you wanted to see them do well because it was your club. Now what we're seeing, though, I think, is the problem is they're having to also try and cater for this elite thing, so they're trying to develop players for elite, whereas before that just evolved, that the elite system or whatever the clubs would then come to your club and say, John, we think you've got some talent, we'd like you to come and trial with us and maybe train with us for a week, we'd like to see what you're like. Now they're expecting the clubs to do the development for them, and I think that that's where it's all gone a little bit haywire in my book.
Yeah, it's a lot of people in club land are frustrated by tug from both sides, and it's very difficult.
I mean, Alex touched on that. He goes, you know, how there's, if you look at it, 70% of sport is about just playing for the fun, the enjoyment, for physical exercise, and they have no ambition to go to a higher level.
And sometimes it's obvious to kids. They don't need to be told. That you don't need to tell a team of 13 or 14-year-olds who the best player in the team is. You don't need to put them through that. You can just say, you're going to go and train with that mob, and you'll come back and keep playing with your mates.
But it's like we mentioned Steph Curry, you know, the basketballer in that interview, yeah. How he's one of those who advocates that you play other sport. And there was a brilliant article written about how if you allow children to play other sports and not specialise at a young age, one of the great things that they learn is so exactly what you're saying, John. They might excel in one sport, and everybody can see that they excel. But then they'll go and play another sport, and there'll be another child that excels in that. So they learn how to play second fiddle, or how they're treated by that player who's super. So they actually learn life skills that are very, very important about being part of a team, and how to react, and how to work as a team, because they're not quite so good at those other sports. So then when they go back to the one they're really good at, they hope they usually bring those skills that they learnt where they weren't so good into that and become a better player in their own environment.
And of course, there's the totally unknown and unfathomable world of parental expectation. And that is a factor in all of this as well. It's a huge factor, and it's a hard to quantify exactly how you can measure that.
I think it's become a huge problem. I think we've seen this in... across so many sports, to me, in the last 20 years, where parents have gone onto committees, which they always used to, but now they're interfering. So they're trying to influence coaches to get little Johnny or little Susie a game, or to get her upgraded to a certain level. I mean, I know examples of people that have been on state body boards and they've prevented a state team being announced because their child was not in it, and they wanted an investigation as to why their child was not selected. Now, that delayed the state team announcement. I think it was by 10 days. And what annoyed me was the rest of the board should have just said, no, you don't like it, go. You know, we trusted the coach, we appointed the coach selected the team, that's it, end of, goodbye.
Well, the other side of this whole parental expectation thing is that the people prey on that. And when I say people, I mean sports organisations prey on that. Pay for this course, get your kiddie in this clinic. There's all that aspect of it as well, where people are actually, you could say, gouging parents, using the hope of little Johnny being able to play for Australia one day. I mean, no coaching course is going to, I'll tell you now, no coaching course is going to let Johnny play for Australia if he ain't good enough to start with.
Or he hasn't got the right attitude.
There's so many factors. It is incredible. I would have loved to have played for Australia. And I went to a couple of coaching clinics and that, but it was painfully obvious that I was never going to be good enough to play for Australia. But it doesn't stop you from enjoying your sport or continuing to compete or finding your level of competition. And that's really important. Putting kids in a place and a position where they can enjoy it. I've seen so many kids come up through the ranks of sports and they get into a team in St. Finally, they're not good enough to be playing one, so they're playing down the grades a little bit. They're trying to follow through with their love for hockey. They get put in a team that's probably played a few seasons together out at left wing. There you go. And they play out there for 4 weeks and they get hit the ball twice because no one trusts them or no one's prepared to invest in them. And they lose their passion and they move on. And part of the important thing about keeping these kids involved with the game is making them feel wanted, putting them in places where they feel like they're part of the team. Now, it may very well be that young Billy, not Johnny this time because he's already playing cricket, young Billy, he might actually be a fantastic left wing. But unless you make him feel like he's a fantastic left wing, he will lose all sorts of love for the game and walk away from it. And we see that far, far too often.
It's funny because I was actually talking to someone the other day who they were saying that they never played for Australia. They played for the state at a sport and they said they didn't believe that they were ever that good to play for the state, even though they played numerous times. They said, but the difference was the coach made me feel I was good enough. Now that, I thought, is the biggest compliment you could ever give a coach.
Yep.
That even now, looking back with hindsight, and they played a lot of games, they said they still didn't feel that they should have been in that side, but that the coach made them believe that they deserved to be there. And that's incredible to me. And I think that is, sometimes we underestimate the influence one person can have on a child or a player's career in making them achieve or just play or just enjoy it. You know, I had a coach, I mean, I hated playing hockey, absolutely detested it, didn't want to play, and then had one coach came along, knew how to get the best out of me, suddenly completely changed my attitude to the game.
Absolutely. And it's sad that we've got to the place now where you're getting coaches at the junior level that are as there much for themselves and their own success as they are for any of the children that they happen to be coaching, and see that a lot as well, and that's really disappointing. I think the basis of it is genuine, but I think it becomes very disingenuous very quickly.
It does indeed. Well, we've probably taken up your time for a topic because we've gone quite a long time there,
well,
John.
Well, we have, but what are you doing over there? I thought, why don't you come and sit down over here at the bench, mate?
I'm a bit of a dunce, you know. When I was at school, you had to stand in the corner, John, when you're the dunce. You know,
well, explains that funny hat you've got on there.
It does indeed. Well, on the last podcast, you would think the amount of hockey I've commentated that I would know that a shootout is 8 seconds. For some reason, I actually said 9 seconds. So I thought I'd better stand in the corner and take my punishment.
You're wrong again. No, they're 11 seconds now, aren't they? I'm sure they're 11 seconds. I was counting. I was watching the game on the weekend. They're now 11 seconds. Hey, just before we go, though, I just wanted to say thank you very much for the last 500 episodes. I've been sitting here on your coattails for a long time now, listening to interviews with the most amazing people, having the opportunity to chat to some amazing people over the time. I mean, I can't even remember some of their names now, but I remember the stories, the blind downhill skier.
Oh, yeah, I can't remember his name. He was phenomenal. Broke the world record, yeah.
But the whole story was fantastic. We got to speak to the cricketer. His name escapes me.
Which one?
You can tell I didn't prepare this beforehand. had the beer at the Palace Hotel. His first cold beer was at the Palace Hotel.
Oh, yes, Sir Alec Bedser.
Sir Alec Bedser. God, I can...
Yeah.
That was just fantastic. And along the way, there's been plenty... Madison D. Rosario, the Barbie girl.
That is fantastic.
Brilliant. It's just been amazing to be around it, Ashley. You've done a tremendous job for supporting all sorts of different sports, you know, the differently abled sports, the sports that don't get noticed by anybody, all that sort of stuff. It's been brilliant, and I don't know how long Slogger can keep going for, mate, but...
I think as long as we got listeners, look, thanks for that. But I think we should also acknowledge, you know, Darren Harper was involved. Clint Ford was there. We had Dan Israel. We had Michael Fontaine, Ryan Cope.
Yep.
Olivia Vivian also helped us out, and Cody Blay. I think that's everybody that's kind of co-hosted along the way with us.
It's been an amazing journey and some fabulous people, and giving some access to sports that no one really... rarely hears about, and issues that people don't really talk about very often either. So, well done, mate.
Thank you very much.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It's in foul.
See ya. We'll be back next week.